This is the Vermont Edition podcast. You know what makes a great podcast? Editing. This episode is shorter than the version you heard on air. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. An event in Stowe this weekend has garnered national attention, as much for the protest against it as for the event itself. A local chiropractor named Bradley Rausch is billing his event as Hope and Healing for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders. One of the controversial speakers he lined up for the event was the discredited British doctor Andrew Wakefield, whose writings correlating autism and the MMR vaccine have been repeatedly and vociferously refuted in scientific studies. In fact, Wakefield was stripped of his medical license when it was discovered that he had multiple ethical violations related to his autism vaccine research. But his debunked conclusions continue to lead worried parents to not vaccinate their children. Wakefield is no longer speaking at the event on Saturday, but the conversation about vaccines and concerns that parents have about vaccine safety persists. So we're going to talk about it today. We're not going to debate the science over whether vaccines cause autism. Overwhelming scientific evidence shows that they do not. But we are going to talk about why misconceptions and wrong information linger and about legitimate concerns around vaccine safety. We've asked two experts to join us to answer your questions about vaccines. Dr. Rebecca Bell is an ICU pediatrician at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Bell, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Finley is chief of the immunization program at the Vermont Department of Health. Chris Finley, nice to have you back on the program as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Bell, I want to give you a chance first to talk a little bit about that doctor I mentioned, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and this debunked study, which, first of all, was not a study. It was an observation. But can you explain where this controversy started?
Yeah, sure. So in the late 1990s, Andrew Wakefield and some of his colleagues published a paper, which was not, as you mentioned, not a study, but an observation of a dozen children, of which eight of them were reported to have regressive symptoms after the MMR vaccine. And he reported some clinical findings and some autism diagnosis with those patients. The actual study is it's always a good idea when you have a scientific hypothesis. If researchers notice something that they think, maybe there's a link here, it's fine to put together an observational study. Where you go from there then is scientists and researchers need to replicate that data, and they need to do so across a wide variety of populations, so many different children over many different areas over a long period of time. And that was done subsequent to his paper.
And done more than once.
Done more than once. Over a million children have been studied over many continents. You know, we have studies, especially in places like Scandinavia, where you have hundreds of thousands of children studied because they keep such good records there. And we've not been able to find any link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Over the course of the decades when that has been studied, other things have been discovered about Wakefield's original study that put even those observational results into question. There was some falsification of data. There were some ethics violations. There were many conflicts of interest. Because of that, he was stripped of his medical license. But going back to the beginning, the original study really didn't show a link. It brought up the question. And then that question was appropriately studied. I think, you know, whenever you have a question in science, it's great to go ahead and do some robust studies. And that was done. And as I mentioned, there's a very robust collection of data showing that there's no link.
There is this question of correlation and causation, and that's something that often comes up for parents when we talk about autism and vaccines. And Chris Finley, maybe you can talk a little bit about the correlation, because the timing for when autism is often first noticed in children and noticed by physicians and noticed by parents coincides often with when the MMR vaccine is given at around 12 months, right? So it's this question of what's causing what and when things are noticed, which often is around the same time as that vaccine.
And this comes up with many things. And what we realize is that as children are growing and getting many vaccines during that time period, that is when different things will happen. And so what you have to understand is it causing it or is it just correlated around the same time period? And there's been many studies looking at children who have autism and children who don't have autism and who received the vaccine and And they've looked backwards, they've looked forwards, they've done prospective studies on it to try and understand that. They even published a study recently that looked at children who had older siblings that had autism, because they would be at higher risk, you would think, of having autism if they received the MMR vaccine, and they found absolutely no association even in that group.
So why does this idea continue to persist? Because it does. I mean, we know it does, and we will hear from parents today probably also who say, you're not telling the truth. This is what I've been told. Here are the sources that have told me this. They tell me not to trust you. You work for the government. So why is this a belief that persists?
Communication research shows that once you hear something and believe something, even if you find out that it's not true, it's harder to let go of that. And there's been a lot of reports in Scientific American and different places looking at why do people hold so strong to a worldview they have, even though it may be proven that it's not. And so it's very hard to let go of that. And once that fear gets in you and you want to protect your child, you have to really work to listen to that and understand it and work with your so that you can accept it.
Dr. Bell, I mean, one of the other things that seems to be maybe happening as well is that it's really hard to refute a cause that is disproved when there's no real understanding of what causes autism. And that is such a concern to any parent. You want your child to be safe. You want your child to be protected and healthy. And, children function and have wonderful lives with autism. But if there's a way to prevent it, you want your child to have the best life possible. And so is that also an issue that you can't say as a doctor, it's not the MMR vaccine, it's this?
That's exactly right. And so when parents say to their pediatrician, how do I, prevent autism? And the pediatrician says, I can't give you an answer to that. And, that's what we have to say. We don't have all the answers. We know that that we think that fetal brain development can affect progression to autism at some point. We don't have good answers, a good satisfying answer. And so we're professionally obligated to be truthful and to present the facts and just say we don't know. But then if they're hearing from other people who don't have that professional obligation and instead can just say, just don't vaccinate your child, that is a more satisfying answer to a parent because it puts them in control and they can protect their they feel like they can protect their child by doing something. The problem with that is, one, it's not true. So the vaccine is not associated with autism. And two, it leaves a child vulnerable to infectious disease.
Sometimes, though, they're hearing this from people who are medical professionals. I mean, Andrew Wakefield was a doctor when he made those original claims, and it's difficult to say, trust this doctor, but don't trust that doctor.
Yes, that's true. So again, he has since been stripped of his medical license, but it can be complicated when you try to look at someone's credentials to see, are they someone that has a lot of expertise in this area or not. But what we recommend is we do have professional organizations. So, for instance, the American Academy of Pediatrics represents a huge number of pediatricians. It's the pediatric professional organization. And so going to a professional organization like that, the American Academy of Family Physicians, those types of organizations can actually represent the scientific consensus.
Julia is calling in from Stowe. Hi, Julia. Go ahead.
So, I am a parent of two small children and a Stowe resident. And I think that, as soon as these speakers were announced, there were many, many people from our community who took issue with the fact that this was happening in our public high school. And I know that for me, I had a visceral reaction to these speakers using our public space to share information that is just not grounded in fact and that has, very real and serious health implications for our region. So, it wasn't surprising that kind of a broad coalition of community members came together, and we've been working really hard to kind of say that, to the wider community, Stowe doesn't believe that this event represents our values. We respect evidence-based medicine. We want to protect our babies and our expectant mothers and the immunocompromised and neurodiverse individuals as well. And so, people have been asking if there's going to be a protest at the actual event, and we really didn't want to do that. We just thought that's not in keeping with our values. So we are actually staging a bake sale that's going to take place at the Alchemist Brewery on Saturday from 10 to 2. And we really want it to be a positive and festive event that's going to be supporting autism advocacy organizations and Doctors Without Borders. So if people really want to stand up to public health or stand up for public health, we'd welcome you to come to this bake sale, which has been dubbed the Cupcake Protest. So
Julia, thanks for your comments. Appreciate that. Also, just want to point out this question that Julia raises about public space being used for this event. My understanding of it, and Chris Finley, maybe you know a little bit about this as well, but is that public schools in Vermont are not able to say, we do want this event, we don't want this event because we don't agree with it. Basically, as long as it's not considered a public safety risk, they sort of have to have the event and don't have the ability to say yes or no in one way or another, right?
That's correct.
Let's go to Tana calling in from Milton.
So I appreciate this conversation that's happening. I chose to not vaccinate my kids early on and have taken a later vaccine approach with the doctor and with them. And they are fully vaccinated at this point. And my trouble early on was not being able to have any kind of really rational conversation with parents and even some doctors, doctor friends of mine, doctor relatives, and people either shut down or became really irrational and really overly emotional, where we couldn't actually sit and talk about the information that is out there. And my choice had nothing to do with autism. It had to do with a whole bunch of other stuff. So I appreciate the rational conversation that's happening. And at the same time, I'm hoping that your speakers could address the concerns that some of us do have about vaccines and what, you know, vaccine reactions and what about people who are immune, you know, have a compromised immune system and maybe it would be better for them to take the vaccines at a different pace than what is, you know, the typical 18-month or whatever the typical schedule is, and you know, how to understand and really catch a vaccine reaction and how to treat a vaccine reaction. I know they're more rare. I know it's sort of on the rare side, but I think that might, aside from the autism stuff, that might also be a reason why people are choosing not to or choosing to go at a different pace. And I'm hoping you guys can really address that today as well.
Tana, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing that. And, you know, Chris Finley, one of the things that comes up, I think, in these conversations is parents who have legitimate concerns, who have real concerns, who know that there are reactions to vaccine, often feel like that is completely discounted in this conversation because public health officials have to do so much pushback of the kind that you've just been doing now. So Tana's saying, look, there are concerns, and can we address them, and can we talk about what fears are rational fears that parents should be addressing with their pediatricians about vaccines?
I think you've hit on one of the most important debates that's going on now, and what it needs to be is a conversation. And as our nation has become more polarized over many things, it feels like so many topics sort of digress into a debate. And I'm sorry that she didn't feel like she was supported, because many parents are questioning and trying to understand, why is the schedule so many vaccines at 2, 4, and 6 months? What does it mean? Why did they do that? One of the things I have the opportunity to do in my position is to attend the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices meetings in Atlanta, where they make the recommendations. And so I'm able to see and listen, and they're streamed, so everybody can if you want to. But I'm able to hear the reports. And what is important to understand is these vaccines are often studied and tested on the youngest, because that's when the disease can have the worst effects. That's when the illness and the death could be, that the younger babies are the ones that we really worry about with many of these. So the reason that they're starting so young is, and there are so many, is to provide optimal protection at the time when they're at highest risk. I think one of the other things is that 10 to 20 years ago, we had a lot of vaccines that came on the market fairly quickly, hepatitis A and B, rotavirus and different ones. So the vaccine schedule seemed to change every year for a little bit, and it felt like there's a lot. And when you look at it, it can almost look overwhelming. And it's important to recognize that actually you're exposed to less antigen because of the improvement in how vaccines are made And also there's combination vaccines that have been studied extensively. So
less antigen than somebody 30 years ago might have been,
you mean.
So even though babies are getting more vaccines in number against more diseases today than they were when their parents were babies, they're getting fewer antigens. And explain what antigens are and why that's a question and concern.
Well, the quality of the vaccines has improved and the science has improved. And so basically with vaccines, what we're doing is giving you a very small amount of what the disease is so that your body can respond to it and develop its immunity to it.
Yeah, and just to add to that, that just to put actual numbers to that. So when you compare the number of antigens in the entire vaccine schedule, childhood vaccine schedule, say in 1960, 1980, and today, children today are receiving 20 times fewer antigens all combined, even though we have many more vaccines compared to parents today or grandparents. So when a parent says to me, you know, I received a small fraction of the vaccines my child's receiving, I let them know that they actually did receive 20 times the amount of antigens that their child received. And babies are exposed to antigens all the time just in their world. These are just proteins and sugars that they're exposed to. And even that level in 1960, 1980 was very safe.
You know, people do as, you know, I'm thinking back to 9 months ago when my little daughter was born and she's so tiny. And you do think all of this stuff going into this tiny little baby's body. How do you reassure parents that you're not overloading a very, very small human being's body?
So our children are really resilient. And I understand this. I remember when my child got his first vaccine and he cried and you just remember that moment because it's a very dramatic moment. But you don't remember all the moments leading up to that. So in the days and weeks of, you know, your infant's life, they've been exposed to far, far more antigens, to pathogens, and they've handled that okay. We remember the vaccine because it was a very dramatic moment, but it's a small blip in what a child deals with all the time.
Chris Finley, we've talked about that safety piece of it, but what are the risks? What are the risks of vaccines for babies and children?
So there's mild risks, and oftentimes that shows that you're having a response to the vaccine, and those are by far the most common that you're going to see, and that's that red tenderness at the site, possibly a fever, a little bit of crankiness. But then there's the risks that people worry most about are very, very rare, and they are estimated to be 1 in 1,000,000, and that's an anaphylactic, a full reaction to that, and that's noted very early that you would want to look at that.
Are there allergens in vaccines that sometimes affect children?
Rarely children can be allergic to a component of a vaccine, and if that's identified, oftentimes they won't receive that vaccine again.
I'll read you a few of the comments that have come in today so far. Mia says, I'm the parent of a 6-year-old who recently finished 27 months of chemotherapy for leukemia. She won't be fully re-immunized for several more months and remains at high risk from preventable diseases like the measles. I fear events like the one at Stowe High School will weaken the public health safety net for vulnerable Vermonters like my daughter. I'm glad the school system publicly distanced themselves from the event. Without it, there was an implied endorsement that sent the wrong message to parents. I hope other schools and institutions charged with upholding principles of science, public health, and fact-based education use more discretion in the future. We got a note from Dr. Katie Marvin, who says, I'm a physician at Stowe Family Practice and enjoy nothing more than taking care of children in my community. What bothers me the most about this event is the lack of attention from the problems that actually cause harm to our youth. Childhood trauma, poverty, mental illness, car accidents, drownings, obesity, poisonings, parents suffering from substance use disorder, firearms, and too much screen time, just to name a few. For us to give attention to these speakers who are promoting bad science is a waste of time. The children in our communities deserve attention to dangers that are actually proven to cause harm, and for our families who have a child with autism. They, too, deserve better evidence-based solutions, intervention, and care. Dr. Julie Veith says, I'm a board-certified emergency physician. I've seen vaccine-preventable illnesses in both children and adults. Some have been truly devastating, and I would not wish this awful experience that parents and children have gone through on anyone. Vaccines are one of the biggest scientific and public health advances of the last 200 years. I sympathize with parents who don't want to cause pain to their children with a vaccine. As a mother to two young children, I do shed a quick tear every time my child feels that quick pinch of the needle. But as a physician, I breathe a sigh of relief knowing that they're protected from deadly illnesses. Choosing to not vaccinate your children because of fear of the unknown, fear of false science, or this disbelief that our pediatricians are only doing this to pad their wallets, many actually lose money providing vaccines, puts not only your own children at risk, but children who can't be vaccinated due to their own illnesses or medications they require. Please protect our children. Jennifer Stella, though, who's president of the Vermont Coalition for Vaccine Choice, writes, even if vaccines do not cause autism, they do carry known risks. What are some of those risks listed in the manufacturer's warnings? Who gets consent over medical procedures? You or the state, the parents or the school, the individual or the collective, the employee or the employer, the patient or the doctor? This is a question of consent for medical procedures being performed on healthy babies and children. And let's take that up. Chris Finley, I want to turn to you first just to explain a little bit about what Vermont law requires when it comes to childhood immunization. So what does the law require?
So the law requires vaccines to enter into childcare, school, and college. The vaccines are consistent with the recommended schedule by the CDC, but they don't include every vaccine that's on there because we look for the risk within the school. And what we do is we annually have the schools, childcare, and colleges all report in aggregate form what the immunization rates are so that we can assess protection and look at that. And I'm pleased to say that we just released this year's for 2016-2017, and 94% of all Vermont students, that's public and independent schools in grades K through 12, had received all the required vaccines.
How different is that from previous years?
It's continued to bump up a little bit, to increase. And what we, when legislation was passed in 2012 and in 2015, there was concern about the level of non-medical exemptions, be that philosophic or religious, in kindergartners. And this year we have, without the philosophic exemption, there was questions of what would happen. And only 3.7% of kids have the religious exemption. And so that's down from a range of, over the last 8 years, from a range of 5.3 to 6.1%. So we're definitely making progress.
And again, just to make sure that the legal framework here is absolutely explicit. These laws regarding childhood immunizations are if you are going to enter your child into a public child care setting or a school or a college, you are not required to immunize your child if you choose to keep your child at home and homeschool your child. Is that correct?
Right. You can homeschool your child. Yes.
I mean, obviously, that's a huge burden to many people. That's insurmountable. But it is not a legal requirement that you absolutely must vaccinate your child.
No, and the religious exemption still stands in this state.
And of course, the medical exemption. Dr. Bell, which children might need to get or what conditions in a child might require that child to have a medical exemption or to not get all of the scheduled immunizations?
Well, one of the commenters mentioned that her daughter was not up to date on her vaccines after receiving chemotherapy. So that's an example of a child who may not be up to date on their vaccines if their physician has decided that they cannot receive certain, say, live vaccines. Others, it has become more rare for children to have true allergic reactions because of the way the vaccines have been purified over the years. But there certainly can be children who do have an allergy to a component of one of the vaccines, and in that case, they wouldn't receive further doses. So children may be partially immunized for those reasons. And then that makes it even more important that all of those children who can be immunized are immunized to protect those who may not be able to receive it or may, you know, have an allergy.
And people may be familiar with the phrase herd immunity, and that's what you're talking about there, with the overwhelming majority of people being immunized can often protect a population from certain diseases. But can you go a little bit deeper in explaining herd immunity and how many children or how many people in a population need to be immunized in order to have that herd immunity?
So that level is different for each disease. So something like measles, we really need to be in the low to mid 90% of our population needs to be vaccinated to really protect the population, meaning that if a case of measles came into the population, it wouldn't spread. if you think about, you know, we talked a little bit about how, for instance, the MMR is not given until a child's a year old. So every child under a year is not protected from measles, even if the parents intend to give them the vaccine. Same thing. We see a lot of babies, very, very small babies I see in the pediatric ICU who have pertussis, for instance. So we really depend on – that's why we recommend that parents and grandparents and, you know, child care providers get vaccinated for that so that they don't pass that on to the child. So that level varies depending on what the disease is. And then there are others that there's no herd immunity for. So for tetanus, for instance, even if everyone around you is vaccinated for tetanus, if you're exposed to tetanus, and I had a patient recently who was not vaccinated who got tetanus, it doesn't help you that other people have it. You need to get it for yourself to protect your child from that disease.
We got a note from Christina who says, do infants receive immunization from their mothers as long as they are breastfed? I had also heard that peanut butter allergies could have been caused by some vaccinations incorporating substances from peanuts. Is there any truth to that? Thanks. Okay, so two questions there. One is the immunity that children who are breastfed can get from their mothers, and then questions about peanut allergies.
So what the infant can get from their mother is while they're still in utero, they can get the benefits of what we call passive antibodies. So we recommend that all mothers, even if they've received the what we call the Tdap, so the tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis vaccine recently, get it again while they're pregnant. They will build up their own antibodies. That does cross the placenta, and then that will protect the child for some time. Although passive antibodies, so antibodies that your mom made that you get, aren't going to be as good as what the child creates once a child's old enough to get the pertussis vaccine for herself. In terms of breastfeeding, we really encourage breastfeeding. There's lots of different types of what we call immunoglobulins that can get passed from breast milk to the child, but not antibodies that will really protect from a specific disease. So we have antibodies that can help with protect from, say, a GI infection, a gastrointestinal infection. But unfortunately, just by breastfeeding, you can't pass on all of your antibodies onto your child and protect your child fully.
And then peanut allergies. I don't know whether, Chris Finley, do you know anything about peanut allergies or Dr. Bell?
No, I actually don't know about that one, but that's something I could look up and get back to you on.
We got a note from Chaya who says, how are hepatitis A and B diseases that infants need protection from at birth? I think the reason that we as parents have a hard time trusting doctors is because they say things like this that are just not true. There's a huge push from the moment you give birth to get lots of vaccines done very early. I'm not anti-vaccine, but I strongly agree with the previous caller that it's really hard to have a conversation about alternative ways to do it. Chris Finley, you want to address that?
I'd be happy to. Hepatitis B can be transmitted through blood and body fluids. And what we know is that if an infant is infected with hepatitis B, they have a 90% risk of having chronic hepatitis B throughout their lifetime and probably dying early. What we found in terms of reducing hepatitis B is that if we can identify mothers that have it, and protect those children right away, not only with vaccine, but immune globulin when they're born, they're better. But what happens is that the moms aren't always identified. They might not be tested, although doctors try to test. Some people aren't in prenatal care. They may have had an exposure between the test and when they had it. The labs may have been read wrong. And I've been part of a work group that is working on this, and I have to say I started to wonder, gee, does it really have to be a birth dose? And after I listened to the concern and to the research that was there, basically what you're doing is you're providing protection from the moment, you know, within the first 24 hours of birth from a disease that if your child does end up getting, they could be sick for the rest of their life. Hepatitis A, which is different, isn't the vaccine's not recommended until 1 year of age.
Is that a conversation, though, that it's appropriate to have with your providers, whether it's an OBGYN and you're talking about getting a Hep B test late in your pregnancy or with the child's first physician who comes in those early days? I mean, is that a conversation that you can have that's appropriate to say, here's my situation, how can we discuss this?
Oh, absolutely. You've got this brand new baby that you want to protect and as much as you possibly can, and anything seems like might seem like a risk. I actually think it's really helpful if pregnant women can think about about vaccines before they're in the throes of trying to deal with a new infant and all the challenges that go with that.
Yeah, or in labor. And because it happens very fast once that child is born. I mean, you may not be in the best position in those first early hours after your child is born to be making those kinds of decisions. Rob's on the line with us from Heartland.
I have a few questions. One of them, I had when they were...
Rob, your line is really bad, but I know that you had a question about mercury. So let me just ask that. Is mercury an ingredient that is used in vaccinations today? And why might it ever have been used in vaccines?
So mercury can help prevent any bacterial contamination with it. And despite the absence of any data suggesting that ethyl mercury, which is not methyl mercury, that's contained in vaccines, despite any evidence that showed harm, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Public Health Service recommended the removal of all vaccines given to infants back in 1999. And what happened is that led to widespread misinterpretation of this precaution, and you already had a public that was concerned about the whole MMR and autism piece. At this point, the only vaccine that has thimerosal in it is multi-dose flu vaccine, and all the rest of the children's vaccines do not have that.
And that multi-dose flu vaccine in Vermont still may have thimerosal.
Because, and again, not concerned that it's a risk, but because of perception, we no longer purchase, going forward in the next year, we no longer purchase any multi-dose. So all vaccines that are purchased in Vermont, and we provide, I think, 99.9% of all vaccines for children, do not have any mercury or thimerosal.
I see. So the multi-dose may still have it, but you're not going to get the multi-dose if you're getting vaccinated in Vermont.
Correct.
Okay. We're talking today with Dr. Rebecca Bell, an ICU pediatrician at the University of Vermont Medical Center, and Chris Finley, chief of the immunization program at the Vermont Department of Health. And let's go to Sandy, who's calling in from Lindenville. Hi, Sandy. Go right ahead.
I have a couple of comments. One is just to clarify the myth around Andrew Wakefield's study, and that is that I assume that the people there have read the study, and that the conclusion was that no association was proven between autism and the MMR vaccine, and in fact his recommendation was not to stop vaccinating but to give the vaccine separately, given a separate measles vaccine. And the response to that recommendation was immediate withdrawal of a single vaccine from the market. But I'm really calling on behalf of parents who have been accused of being claiming anti-science in terms of their study of the vaccine. And they choose an alternative vaccination schedule by calling them misinformed or victims of anti-science is just a way to shut down legitimate debate about our children's escalating health problems.
Sandy, thanks for your call. And I'm seeing nods from Dr. Bell and from Chris Finley. Dr. Bell, what do you think? I mean, Sandy's saying parents are shut down for trying to vary the schedule or to have these conversations.
Yeah, and I think that should never happen. I think that we need to be really careful when we talk to families. I think that no parent is anti-vaccine. A parent is a parent. They want to do the best thing that they can for their child. A parent might have questions about vaccines. They may have concerns. They may be hesitant. But, you know, labeling them as anti-vaccine is not helpful and it's not accurate. Every parent should advocate for their child and every parent should come in with questions. And I feel for the callers who've called in already and said they didn't feel like heard. And that's not okay. I think for parents to remember the context of where they're getting their information from is really important. So when a parent is on a website or at an event or listening to a speaker, oftentimes, there's a disclaimer, right? The disclaimer says something to the effect of, this is not medical advice. Please discuss this with your healthcare provider. And I couldn't agree with that disclaimer more because it really shows a stark difference between the obligation that your child's physician has to your child and to your family and everybody else. So everyone has the right to express an opinion, but not everyone has an obligation to be truthful like your physician does. So your physician has an obligation to discuss the facts with you and to be honest when they don't know all the answers, to practice evidence-based medicine and to make recommendations for your child that are the best for your child based on what we know and what the evidence shows. And so we really encourage parents to come and talk to your pediatrician, your family physician, and ask these questions. And we would like to sit down with you and go through some of this because, you know, we were there for you when your infant wouldn't eat. We helped you through her first fever. We helped you through that rash that wouldn't go away, and we want to help you through this. We're invested in your child. We're invested in your family. Compared to maybe somebody who wrote a blog or manages a website or tours around the country speaking, who doesn't know your child and doesn't know your family and doesn't have that professional obligation to recommend the best evidence.
You know, it's interesting when you say all parents are parents first and they want to advocate for their child. And you do want to do absolutely what's best for your child. And often what we hear in this debate, Chris Finley, is you should be thinking about the community. We were talking earlier about herd immunity and how important it is for you to vaccinate your child so that others in your community are protected. And I think for some parents, they feel like my obligation is to my child, and yet I'm being told to think about the wider community.
I think that those are thoughts that probably go through every parent's mind. But I think one of the things is that we know that when there's a high level of immunizations, it's a protective shield. So it's not only protecting the community, but it's also protecting your child. And what's happening with the Somali population in Minnesota, I think, really demonstrates this. They had a vaccination rate of over 90% with the MMR vaccine to protect against measles, and it dropped to 42%. And what we've seen is what can happen with that. And what, right now, we've got 63 cases of measles that are there, and 60 of those cases are unvaccinated. And so we clearly, which shows that the vaccine is effective, but for those people that were really just trying to protect their child as best they could, it becomes a risk. And I think in areas where you may have, we know that there's geographic areas where we may have much lower rates of vaccination, and we can see this when you look at the data in the schools, those areas may be most at risk for vaccine-preventable diseases.
You often hear, though, of populations where there has been where people who have been given the vaccine are getting outbreaks. And so that, again, I think raises a question for people about, well, why get a vaccine if it's not going to prevent my child from getting an illness?
Well, vaccines vary in their effectiveness. The measles vaccine, we know with two doses, is 97% effective. So that's a vaccine that works in my book. The vaccine that protects against pertussis could be improved, is how I would look at it. And so we know that's not as effective. It does decrease the illness, the range of illness and all, but you can't lump every vaccine into one group.
Let's go to Howard calling in from Rutland Town.
Seems that they have a one-fits-all size for vaccination. So when your child is in the fifth percentile and they have a dose, there may be too much for a child to handle. So, you know, as a concerned parent, the thing to do is to talk to your doctor. And, you know, my doctor agreed, yeah, wait until then, you know, as long as she's not being exposed to a ton of people.
Yeah, Howard, your line went a little bit wonky in there, but I have a note from our call screener of I think what you were saying was partly, you know, one size fits all seems like a weird policy. What if you have a child who's very small for his age or her age? Can you vary a schedule based on your child's needs? Dr. Bell, what do you think?
So these vaccines have been really thoroughly studied, and I do emphasize with the caller when they see their little baby and they think about the vaccines. We sort of mentioned how babies are exposed to antigens and pathogens immediately at birth, and the vaccines really are a small blip in what they're exposed to. And when I talk to families about the way the vaccines work, vaccines are actually meant to mimic what happens naturally. So it's meant to give a very controlled dose of something that occurs naturally, you know, a disease. But it does it in such a way that it prompts the immune system to respond in a way that it would naturally. So just as your child is exposed to people with colds and things on the playground, the vaccine is very similar, but it's controlled so the child doesn't get sick. The concern is that when the child does get sick, that's when bad things can happen. And as a pediatric ICU doctor, I see children get sick from vaccine-preventable infections. The babies are the ones that get the sickest. And so then you're talking about doing all sorts of treatments to try to keep them healthy and make them better, whereas the vaccine in and of itself is really this controlled, natural mimicker of what happens in the environment.
So when it comes to a child who's small, for example, that's not a concern for a vaccine.
No, it's not.
But is it appropriate for parents to be talking to their doctors about all of these choices and really asking questions about why is this vaccine necessary? Why is it necessary now? I mean, I think, again, often people feel like my doctor is supposed to be an authority, or I may be categorized in some way if I push against my doctor to try to find out why my child needs this and when. Is it appropriate to have these conversations with your pediatrician?
Absolutely. And I hope parents feel comfortable doing that. And I think part of our job is to really go through the risks versus the benefits. And part of the issue with vaccines is that they've done such a good job of getting rid of the diseases that we don't know. Parents don't know what diphtheria is. They've never seen Hib meningitis. And some of us have seen it. And so to be able to talk to parents about what good the vaccines do can really help them sort out this risk versus benefit question.
That's Dr. Rebecca Bell, an ICU pediatrician at the University of Vermont Medical Center. She's also a board member of the Vermont AAP chapter and assistant professor at the Lerner College of Medicine. Thank you very much, Dr. Bell.
Thank you.
Chris Finley is chief of the immunization program at the Vermont Department of Health. Chris, thanks very much to
you
as well.